The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at an historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laugh as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. We want to start with a shout out to our super producer / legal beagle, or check this out, no, legal eagle, Max Williams.
Caca.
Silly goose. A silly gander of the Michigan variety.
Mm-hmm. And what's good for the goose is, of course, good for the Max. So you're Noel, I'm Ben, and this is part two of an exploration of the sometimes ridiculous history of intellectual property. In part one, Noel, I had made the offhand reference to legal beagle, and I found the etymology. It's kind of uncertain, but it seems like sometime in the 1940s, an attorney wrote a book called The Little Lawyer and Legal Advisor, where he used the term legal eagle, and it transformed over time to legal beagle.
Rhyming, am I right?
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah. I wonder if someone's got a patent on that. Now, previously, we gave everybody a lot of background on the ancient history of IP and how it, you pointed out something I really appreciated, a lot of the modern legal definitions of intellectual property started in Italy, but then Italy picked up the improvements that the United States made. And that's where we get our modern day definition of intellectual property. I mean, first, let's talk about what benefits would it have? Like if you came out with an album, I came out with a novel, or let's say Max invents a new device used in curling. See, I'm relevant to all our interest here. Then what benefits would we have from IP laws?
Exactly. Quite a few. And we've already sort of gotten into this a good bit. But, you know, once it gets a little more kind of ensconced in the law, we really do see these protections start to become really clear. The idea of market value, intellectual property rights allow creators to generate businesses, you know, based on their original ideas and the licensing of those ideas, the sale of products that are based in unique ideas, and also the kind of proliferation and commercialization of those products, goods and services that they are able to benefit from because of those protections.
100%, you know, and this, the big thing here is the protection. So you can prohibit other people from financially benefiting off of your ideas if they violate IP laws. So you can take people to court if they're making money off your ideas in a way that violates these laws. You can file a court case. Like if you are Max, the inventor of the new curling device, and someone else starts just making those without compensating you, then you can sue them. And if they are found guilty, the court will give you a financial reward, or you might have to get a certain percentage of whatever those folks are profiting with, you know?
That's right. And it also, we talked about, you know, the ability to market and sell these services or goods. It also, through that control of these ideas, allows you the power to help raise financing or raise funding, you know, for your business or idea, because you hold an exclusive right, you know, to those ideas. And with that in mind as well, it also gives you the ability to benefit from exports, because if a country can't just make their own version of a thing because that intellectual property is already tied to another business, then the only option there is to import that good rather than create something regionally, because they, you know, they would be infringing on that copyright protection.
And here's the kicker. This stuff, as I said in part one, is imperfect. And these laws, while well-intentioned, kind of inherently create their own issues just by existing. A general term is only useful if it subsumes related concepts. So let's start with the idea, they stole my intellectual property. That concept by itself, without supporting evidence, is kind of uninformative. The general term, intellectual property, is such an umbrella term. It obscures more than it illuminates. If you allege copyright infringement, you have to identify exactly what it is that is being infringed upon and exactly how it's being infringed, right? So take patent law. If someone says, this person stole my invention in some way or some part of my invention, then you have to say, okay, does this quote unquote new invention straight up copy the design of the older one? And when you look at trademarks, you have to say, like, okay, are these golden arches purposefully close to the McDonald's golden arches? Are they meant to trick people into thinking they're eating at McDonald's somehow?
Well, and that also, you know, sort of begs the question, like, is it reasonable to think that a consumer would be tricked in that way? Is that even possible with like the ubiquity of what McDonald's is and how, you know, just all encompassing it is? Like, I don't think it's a reasonable assumption that someone could be tricked into thinking they're eating at McDonald's when in fact it was something else, you know? And once you get into like parody and the idea of like fair use and all of that stuff, which we'll get into, it really starts to get confusing. And we're taking a lot of this stuff in this section here from a really great essay by a professor of philosophy at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York named Sameer Chopra, who has a fabulous essay literally titled End Intellectual Property with the subtitle Copyrights, Patents, and Trademarks Are All Important, but the term intellectual property is nonsensical and pernicious. And it's a dear friend of mine and the show, Peyton Fisher, buddy who we all have hung out with together. He's a lawyer in New York, in Brooklyn himself, and he believes this wholeheartedly. We have had conversations multiple times about the just convoluted nature of intellectual property law and a lot of these kind of patent troll situations where someone is just basically bilking the system, you know, by exploiting this idea of intellectual property, or even some of these lawsuits around like a tune that are, once you kind of look at everything, look at all the evidence, seemingly a bit opportunistic.
I think a lot about software law when this comes into play, like patenting things such as the click of a mouse, right? Or the idea of a window in general, which should be familiar to any fan of the software giant Microsoft. So I also want to shout out again, the excellent work by Bruce Bugbee in 1967, the genesis of American patent and copyright law. For an example of what I'm talking about with impersonation of well-known brands, you can travel to Iran if you can get the visa, and you can see that due to a lot of sanctions, Iranian businesses have been copying or creating fake fast food franchises for many, many years. You probably aren't going to find a McDonald's or a Pizza Hut in Tehran, but you might find a Pizza Hut or a Mashdonald's. Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody. Like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Mint Mobile.
You know, Ben, I got to say, one of the best parts about spring cleaning is that post-clean clarity you get where you're like, man, how have I been living like this? What's wrong with me?
You're right, Noel. It's kind of like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan.
It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month.
To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
That's mintmobile.com/ridiculous. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only.
Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply.
See Mint Mobile for details. There's a great NPR article about this called "Mashdonald's: Iranians Copy American Fast Food Brands." It's a great read.
And that's interesting, too, Ben, based on what we were just talking about earlier, where it's like in America, where there's a McDonald's, you know, every 1,000 feet, it would seem, you're going to be much less likely to be able to make the argument that someone would be fooled by Mashdonald's, thinking that they were actually in a McDonald's. But in a country where McDonald's is not nearly as ubiquitous, you could make the opposite argument that, yeah, definitely you could, if the branding was close enough, that there was an attempt to trick people But then because of the other countries and the way the laws vary, it might be a little harder to enforce. What do you think, Ben? Is McDonald's gone after Mashdonald's or Pizza Hut gone after Pizza Hat?
No, you know, it's interesting. They really haven't, because it's tough to, given all the other geopolitical issues, it's tough for Iran and Western governments to get on the same page for about anything. You know what I mean? So how would you realistically even start that conversation? You know what I mean? It is lower on the list of priorities. And then this goes into, again, the generality, the vagueness of the term. Good legislation, good jurisprudence is all about concrete definitions, and intellectual property has a hard time with that. Because, you know, if you're debating copyright law, you have to wonder, how does copying of academic papers work? Patent law doesn't really apply to that. If you're talking about patent law, you have to wonder whether pharmaceutical companies should have to issue licenses to poor countries for life-saving drugs. Copyright law doesn't really matter there. And I would also say that I have some personal feelings about the way pharmaceutical companies behave internationally. I don't think people should die because they don't have money. But that's, you know, that's a philosophical thing.
And isn't there a similar thing to, like, the idea of a trademark expiring or something entering the public domain as it pertains to generic drugs? Like, after a certain point, isn't something able to become generic, and then, you know, it's kind of up for grabs and different companies can manufacture it?
The big thing about drugs is it's a patent. So it has very strict protections, but only for a set amount of time. Right. Then once that time has passed, it's become, like, you know, in theory, just, like, well known enough that everyone can now have the actual, like, basically the script to how this thing was made.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the generic, right?
That's when generics come out. That's like, you know, you get the generic, like, you know, Allegra's and stuff like that, and it's literally the same ingredients as the original version of the drug, because we have that script.
So that means that at that point, the original manufacturer has to release that information. They have to, like, make the recipe available.
Yeah, I'm like 99% certain, because you have to give the recipe in the patent. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. So, okay, got it.
And it becomes even more complicated when you look at countries like India. So right now, India is the largest democracy on the planet, and it very much in need of some life-saving medications. And they did something that really ticked off a lot of Western countries, where they said, look, we know how to make this. We're not going to have people die just because they're poor. So we're going to make our generic versions. You guys deal with it. And for some folks, that makes the government of India villainous. And for other folks, it makes them heroes, especially the people who had their lives saved as a result of that decision. So there's a lot involved here. And the rubber does hit the road. What we're saying is, this is, although it might sound dry at times, this is very much important mission critical stuff for human society at large. We also have the idea of fair use, which we deal with so often here in podcast land. It's the reason that we decided with reluctance to put in our own Law and Order spin on the Casey on the Case sound cue. Because we didn't want Dick Wolf mad at us. And you have to be very, very careful with what qualifies as fair use.
Well, and of course, as we've often run against, and as our policy kind of as a company has become, fair use isn't an ironclad protection. You can't just say, fair use,
no.
Boom, leave me alone. Right. No, it's just a defense that you have to then use in court, and you still have to go to court and defend your position, and that's very, very expensive, especially for a big company. And if you're a big company, that makes you a target for these types of lawsuits. And so sometimes it's just better to err on the side of safety than it is to depend on some sort of fair use argument, whereas, like, a DJ or an under the radar kind of indie artist might be more likely to give it a role.
Yeah, fair use very much has, like, the self-defense argument, where if you believe you're going to court and say it was self-defense, and they're like, oh, that's okay, that's fine, you're in a lot of trouble. Like, you really have to make a good case for it. It's not just say, you know, get out of jail free card.
Exactly. It's not like tagging base. You have to explain why you should be able to tag base. And like you said, Noel, you can enter into a war of attrition legally, right? Especially if the other side wants to make it super inconvenient, then you go into appeals that can last for years and years and years, and you can just hemorrhage money and time. The other thing is the idea of non-obviousness. This can come up in patent law, but it can't. It doesn't really come up in copyright law. So what we're saying essentially, and you don't have to be a lawyer for this one, what we're saying is that intellectual property is a broad term that applies to all sorts of things that are in truth their own distinct areas of legal concern. So copyright law is not the same as patent law. Trademarks are not the same as other IP violations, right? So because of this, like we're citing in this wonderful essay, just using intellectual property as a concept all the time indiscriminately, it leads to absolutely absurd situations. Anything associated with a creator is grouped under this huge umbrella, and that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, what does make sense, though, is that it gets so murky, because we know what property is for the most part. You know, it's tangible. It's an asset. It's like a thing that you can catalog and you know, tag and put in a ledger of some kind, like a car or a house, you know, or a piece of equipment or something like that. That's property. And we are guaranteed to our property. But an idea is a little more slippery than that, because what led to the idea? What are the guts, you know, the sort of foundations of the idea, and where do those aspects come from, and who owns those? So it's a lot harder to pin down an idea than it is, like, you know, a Volvo.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's a good way to say it. And when we see this, we also see enormous opportunity for something we alluded to in part one, the idea of so-called patent trolls, the concept that there are people who know how to weaponize this incredibly Byzantine, imperfect system, and they're not there because they want their patent to help the world. They're not there to really protect their rights in good faith. They are there to get money from other people. And there are thousands of ways to do this. And in doing that, what we see is a lot of the really important stuff about IP gets lost in this semantic mire, this war of words, the notion of borrowing, reusing, reworking, remixing stuff. You need all of this for culture and art and science to grow. Perhaps Pablo Picasso was right when he said, what is it? Good artist copy, great artist steal.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know what, dude? Even that phrase has been repurposed and associated with so many different people who maybe said that. So it's like parallel thinking is also an issue, right? Two different parties thousands of miles away might legitimately come up with the same idea at the same time. And then you have all kinds of, you know, problems that can arise from that. I do want to there's a really great definition of patent trolls from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I'm just going to read it right off of their article on patent trolls. They describe patent trolls as someone who uses patents as legal weapons instead of actually creating any new products or coming up with new ideas. Instead, trolls are in the business of litigation or even just threatening litigation. They often buy up patents cheaply from companies down on their luck who are looking to monetize what resources they have left, such as patents. Unfortunately, the patent office has a habit of issuing patents for ideas that are neither new nor revolutionary, and these patents can be very broad, covering everyday or common sense types of computing. This is specifically referring to your point, Ben, software. Things that should have never been patented in the first place. And this does not just have to attached to software. This is the case for any type of patent. And, you know, because the patent office is probably overwhelmed. And so they maybe something's slide through the cracks. And so these patent trolls are taking advantage of this system rather than using it as a means of innovation. And if anything, to your point, Ben, they're slowing it down and possibly doing serious damage. There was a patent troll that we ran up against very early on in our podcast careers because How Stuff Works was listed as a defendant in a patent troll case involving the concept of podcasts.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because the idea of a podcast was that it was serialized content placed on a feed, you know, an RSS feed, which stands for really simple syndication. So a feed, an RSS feed was originally used for things like, I believe, news groups, or maybe it was just like reading lists and things like that. And then somebody figured out how to repurpose it and use it for, you know, compressed audio in a serialized form. And therein lied the advent of podcasting as we know it. But this patent troll targeted folks like Jimmy Kimmel and How Stuff Works and some other kind of early big names. I think Mark Maron, but ultimately did not win because that would have been really bad.
Yeah, podcasts would not have been a thing, or they would have changed. They would have had to change by necessity. So because of this indiscriminate use of the concept of intellectual property, there have been numerous legal disasters. Copyrights have grown without limit, almost. Again, they were supposed to be temporarily limited, but that hasn't been the case. Congress drastically increased copyright terms in 1976, then again in 1998. I mentioned this in part one, but a big piece of this was the Disney Corporation. They were lobbying for decades to retain exclusivity over Mickey Mouse and not to let the poor guy get into the public domain, not to let old Steamboat become a man of the people, or a mouse of the people, as it were. Right. And so in other cases, you see that people who are using intellectual property also suggest that protections be passed on to an heir of some sort. Like the notion of inheritance that comes from real estate would also apply to copyright law. So like, let's say your great grandfather is T.S. Eliot or something like that. Then does that mean that you have the copyright over the wasteland? You know, or Wastelands. Does that mean you own Little Giddings, even though he didn't write it and played no role in the creation? It's a weird question.
It is. And it's interesting, too, because when you deal with, say, music, I believe it's a different ballgame because you have publishing rights versus the rights of the recording itself. So like to every like album or piece of music that's released, there are two sides of the copyright. There's the publishing side, which literally has to be registered as notes on a page and lyrics on a page. And that's one copyright. The other is the actual recording, the masters, exactly. And those are passed down to generations. You know, they'll exist in the estate of a family, and usually you'll see it's members of the estate that are suing kind of down the line. But it's a long time though for something to enter the public domain. So for the fact that we see Mickey Mouse, you know, finally running up against that, it's because he's over 100 years old at this point, right? I mean, right? I believe it was. It's 100 years old. But like there are classical music pieces where the publishing rights are in the public domain, but not the recording by the London Philharmonic.
Right.
So that's different. You know, there's two different sides of that. And we're going to have a good time in a minute getting into some specific and pretty silly examples of some, actual court cases surrounding intellectual property. But it's a murky topic because there are so many different flavors of it. So we just, you know, hopefully we're not getting too bogged down, but I think we've done a decent job of kind of trying to, you know, demonstrate the different ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What we're saying is that this is leading to a huge, messy bowl of spaghetti. Things are going to get even weirder in the US and abroad next year because 2024 is when Mickey Mouse enters public domain at present.
You're already seeing stuff like that with the Winnie the Pooh horror movie. I think Winnie the Pooh just got released. And I think there's certain things you can't do, though. Like, it's not like you just can use the character in whatever way you see fit exactly.
It's the red shirt. You can't exactly. use a red shirt on Winnie the Pooh.
That's weird. A more recent iteration, right? Or what?
Well, I think that is what made it Disney's property. Because Winnie the Pooh obviously predated Disney.
That's right. So we're talking about the book Winnie the Pooh entering the public domain, not necessarily the Disney version. But with Mickey Mouse, we are talking about a character that was originally created by Disney. So what happens if over time a character's design changes, then does that restart the clock?
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Probably. That is probably in the minutiae of the argument, and probably the corporations would love discussing that minutiae as long as you continue the clock further and further and further
it's
out.
Running the clock, and it depends on how good your lawyer is and, frankly, what their relationship with the judge is. I'm just going to say the quiet part out loud. I mean, let's get into – we've done our due diligence on the background and some of the – legal and philosophical concerns. Let's get into the fun stuff. Let's talk about Louis Vuitton and a Haute Diggity Dog.
Exactly.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Louis Vuitton, of course, famous, storied fashion house, you know, fashion brand, known for its haute couture. Haute Diggity Dog, probably not as much of a household name, but there was, in fact, a lawsuit, Louis Vuitton versus Haute Diggity Dog, when in 2006, Louis Vuitton sued this little doggy toy company, Haute Diggity Dog, for trademark, trade dress, and copyright infringement when Haute Diggity Dog created these little plush dog toys under the name Chewy Vuitton. And you've probably seen the iconic Louis Vuitton handbags that are like kind of brown leather with the LV sort of like stamped in like a pattern on them. And that is what Chewy Vuitton used, you know, for their dog toys. So it really, you know, they're obviously not handbags, and I don't think anyone would ever confuse them for that. They're little squishy toys that kind of look like handbags and say Chewy Vuitton and have the
With one T, not two.
It is with one T. Sorry, you're right, Ben. Good point. No, it's with two.
Chewy Vuitton is with one.
Mm-mm. Look at it right now.
I'm looking at it too. I've got it pulled up here.
V-U-I-T-T-O-N.
I'm seeing multiple.
I'm looking at their actual website.
Okay, I'm looking at the images. Let me go to their website and check.
You're right. On the actual things, it's one T, but the URL is two T's.
See?
And the actual logo at the top is two T's. I wonder why they did that.
I think we can tell.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think we keep all this in because this is exactly the kind of stuff we're talking about. So Chewy Vuitton argued that they were essentially doing a parody, you know, it's like, oh, it's silly. This is like fashion, high fashion stuff. Mm-hmm. Let's make it for doggies. And the courts agreed. Louis Vuitton argued that the toys were going to cause brand confusion. Mm-hmm. But then Louis Vuitton doesn't make dog toys.
Right.
So where's the brand confusion? No one is going to mistake a little, you know, cuddly, squeaky dog bag for, you know, an overpriced handbag.
Mm-hmm. And then the court makes the decision that Chewy Vuitton is a, quote, joking and amusing parody and nothing more. So parody, again, qualifies for its own set of considerations, which we mentioned briefly. But just so you know, this is part of the reason why Weird Al does a lot of does so much great work, you know, and the Weird Al situation I love because, interestingly enough, a lot of other musicians consider it a great honor and a rite of passage for Weird Al to parody them.
One guy who didn't like it? There was one guy who really didn't like it.
There was Prince.
He ever did it. He never did a Prince.
Permission to do a Prince one because he would ask people in advance.
He usually does. I think he almost always does, whether as a courtesy or what.
But Coolio didn't like it. You're right. Coolio later apologized to Weird Al.
Because he would always beforehand reach out, and I think he got it from the record label, and he thought he had gotten it directly from Coolio. And Coolio was very mad, saying, hey, you're using my work, man. And so, like, it was one of these situations where he was, like, legally right, but I believe he was, like, really, like, he felt bad about it. He's like, hey, man, I don't want to ever do that to people.
Well, also, like, you could argue that Coolio was thinking it was disrespecting what he considered to be kind of, like, a serious song about a real problem in terms of, like, young people getting tied up in gang violence and all of that, and to make it sort of like a silly goof, he might have felt was in poor taste. And, you know, you could argue that it is in poor taste, but it does come with some protections. But Ben, it's so funny. I just have to add, Chewy Vuitton is a brand in and of itself. So Hot Diggity Dog had their line of Chewy Vuitton toys, but if you look online, there actually is a website that's just Chewy Vuitton, and that's spelled with two T's, whereas the one in the Hot Diggity Dog line is spelled with one T. Mm-hmm. So now we're really getting into parodies of parodies, you know? I mean, it gets deep and weird.
And this is far from the only example. Let's look at David Slater versus PETA on behalf of none other than Naruto the Monkey. So David Slater is a British nature photographer, and he was hanging out with a group of monkeys in Indonesia, celebs crested macaques, and he had no idea that his photography would make a huge legal quagmire. So while he's hanging out with these monkeys, some of them picked up his camera, and monkeys are very intelligent. They took a lot of cool selfies. You could see these. They were viral for a while. And surprise, surprise, when our pal Dave Slater gets home, he sees these photos have been published in all sorts of newspapers, not just like kind of tabloidy stuff like the Daily Mail, but the Guardian and the Telegraph as well. And someone took these photographs, an editor at Wikimedia Commons, and uploaded them to the Wikimedia website. Slater found this and he said, hey, can you take these off your website? Because this is my work. And Wikimedia said, hey, sorry, David, that might have been your camera, but you didn't take those photos. The monkeys did. And we'll go to court over it if you want.
And in fact, there's still a note attached to that license, this Wikimedia Commons thing, which is a very useful tool for, let's say, documentary filmmakers or podcasters, you know, where if it's got a Wikimedia Commons license attached to it, that is a damn good sign that they've done their homework and that it is, in fact, something that is public domain. But the note reads, this file is in the public domain because as the work of a non-human animal, it has no human author in whom copyright is vested.
Mm-hmm. So unless the monkeys go to court, what are you going to say? And like I said at the beginning of this one, you heard the name PETA, Ridiculous Historians. How did PETA get in there? Well, PETA takes Slater to court because of something called the Next Friend Principle of Law. The Next Friend Principle of Law allows you to sue in the name of another person. In this case, the organization PETA is suing on behalf of one of those monkeys whose name is Naruto. And so in 2018, a judge at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has probably one of the weirdest cases in their entire career, and they rule against the selfie-taking monkey. They throw out the copyright lawsuit, and along the way, they heavily criticize PETA, and they say, don't make Naruto an unwitting pawn in your, quote, ideological goals.
We talked about this case in our Animals in Court episode around the concept of animal personhood. And PETA, whatever you think of them as an organization, you can't really deny the fact that they do often do kind of, I guess, let's call them symbolic lawsuits that maybe are wasting a lot of folks' time, but ultimately are an excuse for them to create a press release, but nothing really comes of them.
Or a legal precedent.
That's
so,
true.
Like
correct.
Sue for a dollar so that you can get something, some jurisprudence on the books. We're going to end on two from the world of pop culture. Let's go to Mattel Incorporated versus MGA Entertainment Incorporated. So these are two companies suing each other, and they're suing because of beef between Barbie and the Bratz with a Z.
Yeah, that's right. And this really goes into that whole concept of like something being so derivative that it could be considered an infringement, you know, but that's for the courts to decide, isn't it? And no one's going to make that decision unless a lawsuit is filed. So Barbie, at this point, obviously Barbie's having a real moment right now, real glow up. But at this point, in 2001, Barbie as a brand is already 42 years young when the Bratz dolls with a Z, because they're edgy, you know, hit the scene. I believe the first run of Bratz dolls included Chloe, Jade, Sasha, and Yasmin. And these are like, they're kind of macabre, like giant-headed, you know, puffy-lipped, cartoony sort of, you know, scene girls.
They're like bad Powderpuff Girls.
Really? Yeah, exactly. In terms of the proportions of head to body. But they did really well. Very quickly, I think in the span of just 5 years, they took about 40% of the market share away from Barbie in terms of, I guess, dolls portraying fashion-y young women.
Right, right. Because it's a specific demographic that these toys are for. And so Mattel does what any company would reasonably do there. They try to make a new iteration of Barbie dolls that will bring back some of that market share. And this line of Barbies is called My Scene Barbies. They echo the big-headed, slim-bodied build of the Bratz dolls, and MGA Entertainment doesn't cotton to this. So in April 2005, they sue Mattel and they say, you are infringing upon our Bratz thing. And then Mattel comes back in court because both of these are companies, so they can afford to bleed a little money. They say, well, Bratz has a designer named Carter Bryant. And Carter Bryant made the Bratz doll design while we at Mattel were paying Carter. And this is true. Carter worked for Mattel from 1995 in September to April 1998, and then worked for him again in 1999 to October 2000. And the contract that Carter Bryant signed stipulated that his designs during this time would all be property of Mattel. And you can see this in a lot of other industries. Like, please read your employment contracts carefully, because you might sign something that says any software you create while you're employed or anything you make on a work computer becomes the IP of your employer. So be very careful with that.
That becomes a big plot point in the HBO series Silicon Valley, where like there's an algorithm that one of the main characters is working on, like a compression algorithm. And at some point it becomes a subject in court proceedings as to whether he did that on a computer owned by the sort of Google, you know, stand-in that's in the show. Huli is what it's called. And that's a big deal. Like, if you do anything like that on a work computer, technically it is the product of the company. Like, even maybe if it's not within the scope of your work, you got to wonder that. Like, what if you're like, you know, I have my own computer that I use in my home setup, in my home studio, that I record music on. But if I was using a work computer, all of the stuff that I did with that computer, if I one day sold a song for $1 million or whatever, technically the company could claim that I did it on a work computer, and therefore they would be party to that, those earnings, right? I think. Even if it's not under the scope of my employment
agreement. It can happen that way. Again, we cannot emphasize this enough. You've got to read those contracts carefully, because another example would be whether or not it matters that you were working on company time, which takes precedent, using company equipment or using company time. For example, I have... I've had to negotiate some pretty specific things with non-competes in regards to being a writer, independent of the podcasting stuff. And that is, like, we're very fortunate in that our colleagues and the folks we work with are all, for some reason, big fans of us. So when we have outside projects or work, 99 times out of 100, they're like, you guys are awesome. Go do the thing. That's great. Totally. Yeah. But that doesn't apply to everyone. We're quite fortunate in that regard.
For sure. We also do know that typically non-compete clauses are a little difficult to enforce. You know, sure, they're not always ironclad. But in this case, it did not go in favor of Carter Bryant and the Bratz brand. In July 2008, the jury took the side of Mattel, and MGA, the Bratz, I guess, parent company, had to pay Mattel a whopping $100 million. And also, insult to injury, remove Bratz dolls from the shelves. But something changed, because there's been Bratz movies and stuff, and I think Bratz are back in a big way.
1 year. They had to take them off a shelf for 1 year.
Okay. Yeah. Got it.
And then MGA ultimately prevailed, and they said, we're proving that Mattel has stolen our trade secrets. So these cases are almost never fully done. Thanks to appeals processes, these can go on for so long. One more. This is one for the 80s babies in the crowd today. You may recall, in the mid-1980s, the Reagan administration started something called the Strategic Defense Initiative, or SDI, and immediately everyone in the United States called it the Star Wars program. Most people loved this. One guy who didn't love this was George Lucas, who you may be familiar with.
Yeah, George Lucas. It's like history. It rhymes. Yeah, that guy. He and his production company, Lucasfilm, were annoyed at Uncle Sam or Uncle Ronnie, and it didn't want this association with its brand, with his brand. And by this association, I'm referring to one tied up in war efforts and launching missiles into space and all of that. You know, you want a kind of a clean slate. And in Star Wars, there's very little threat of global annihilation. You know, there's kind of dogfights in space. I mean, there is the Death Star and all of that stuff, but, you know, there really isn't much of like an apocalypse vibe in Star Wars. There's sort of a nice kind of diplomatic way of things working themselves out.
Oh, by the way, the blockade, that was Phantom Menace, not Clone War.
Oh, brought it back.
Or Return
of
the Clones.
It starts with the weird aliens, and they're talking about the blockade, but it comes into play in the second one. And that's
when you
really
start debating. I watched the clip of it to really date this recording. I was editing the Aleutian Islands episode, and I watched a clip, and it's very weird. And it's like, wow, I didn't realize the Phantom Menace was this weird. It all just feels weird. And has all the droids getting blown up, but R2-D2 survives. It's where they introduced R2-D2.
Yeah,
it's really ham-fisted in there. All that whole movie was, it's just a joyless cash grab.
Now, this is interesting. I'm glad we're ending on this one because it's a larger question for us and all the ridiculous historians in the crowd. In 1985, when this lawsuit comes to bear, Lucas doesn't sue the U.S. government, right? Because officially, the U.S. government just has a few politicians who start using the phrase Star Wars program. But he can sue two public interest groups, one called High Frontier and one called the Committee for Strong, Peaceful America. They run these TV messages, these like PSAs, and they refer to this program as Star Wars. And Lucasfilm has a trademark for Star Wars, the movies, the brilliant film franchise that goes into all sorts of things, toys, books, merch, you name it. The federal district court said, sorry, George, we're ruling in favor of the interest group. They are totally fine to call their program whatever they want, even Star Wars, so long as they don't attach it to a product or service for sale. And the court decision even said, look, forever, creators of fictional worlds have seen their vocabulary for fantasy appropriated to describe reality. So that's stuff like, you know, like George Orwell. People reference 1984 and double think all the time. I don't know. What do you guys think about that decision?
I think it's right on the money because, first of all, it wasn't even officially the name of the program.
True.
It was sort of shorthand that was just being thrown around. And that's what happens when you have such a brand that's so ubiquitous as Star Wars. People are going to start using terms from it, you know, in normal kind of parlance, whether it be in conversation or in to describe, you know, things that are bigger than just like civilian kind of activities, right? It makes sense, but you can't put that genie back in the bottle. That's part of having something that sort of really invades the public consciousness. It's gonna get appropriated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. And these conversations continue. In the modern day, there are so many other strange examples we can give you of intellectual property beefs. But for now, I think we can say safely that this stuff often gets very, very ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. No question about it, man. Yeah, this is cool. It's something that we often find ourselves kind of in the midst of in podcasting and have kind of seen some of these things sort of evolve, you know, in our lifetimes, and they're going to continue to do so because it is still, you know, based on the history of it, not so clear. You know, ideas are like, you know, made of spider's webs and magic, as Noel Fielding might say on the Mighty Boosh. It's really hard to pin down.
Mm-hmm. And one thing we can say is that we are continually grateful for all of you folks playing along at home, Ridiculous Historians. Thanks to you. We're also grateful for the help of everybody in the Ridiculous crew. Let's start with a big thanks for super producer, Mr. Max Williams.
Jonathan Strickland, ever may he, you know, live under our symbolic podcast bridge. And we'll always pay that toll because at the end of the day, you know, he's our troll. Christopher Asiotis here in spirit.
Yeah, Yves Jeffcoat. Let's also give a shout out to Gabe Lousier. Let's give a shout out to our research associate for this episode, Dr. Z. And Noel, shout out to you, sir.
You as well, my friend. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.